This podcast brought to you by Petzl. Petzl lighting the trail in like no other headlamp, torch, as Scott likes to say. The reactive lighting lets you see exactly what you need to see. If you're looking straight forward as you're running, it broadcasts light on the trail. If you look forward to find that elusive trail marker, bam, if you're with it now, you've got 350 lumen just beaming down looking for that marker. Now, battery life lasts longer, and you can plug it in and go out every single time with a rechargeable battery that's built within those Now or the Reactive Lighting Tika RXP. Now, here's what I'd like to talk about. We went to Silverton, Colorado, Scott and I, to observe and to be part of, in a peripheral way, Silverton, Colorado, Hard Rock 2014. And we saw just the mecca of trail running. I've got to say, I was so impressed with the San Juan Mountains. So beautiful. The landscape, incredible. Snow, green, red, all the colors represented out there. And the ultra runners that were attending, just fantastic. I mean, the talent on the sidelines was deep, let alone the field. And we got to see Killian running a 22:41:33. Total ascent and descent, 67,000 feet through the San Juan Mountains. Adam Campbell dealing with a lightning strike as he travels over Handy's Peak. I mean, the weekend was full of entertainment. But I'll tell you, probably the greatest thing for me, and had we shown up, traveled that distance, sat down and had an interview or a podcast discussion with the man you're about to hear from, David Horton. We sat down and just had a conversation. The agenda was much like most Trail Runner Nation podcasts. Well, let's sit down and talk about trail running. And we could have easily talked for not an hour, but 5 hours. We started the interview right after the race went off. And so we were all there and we set up and talked. And had I put everything away, packed up the bags and went back home without seeing a single minute of the 100-mile race, it would have been well worth it after sitting down and talking with David Horton. He just made you feel like you wanted to be a better runner. You wanted to be a better person. You wanted to be a better whatever you were being at the time based on his positive attitude and his enthusiasm for life. And when I was done, I was just excited about whatever was next, whether it was running, whether it was being a podcaster or a father or whatever your job or occupation. I just wanted to embrace life like he has and does. He was such an inspiration. So it was my pleasure to see the San Juan Mountains. It was my pleasure to watch Killian Jornet take on that record. It was my pleasure to watch Adam Campbell persevere through lightning strikes. But it was my absolute pleasure to sit with David Horton and talk running. We'd like to thank Petzl for making it possible for Trail Runner Nation to show up to Silverton, Colorado and observe this great race, talk to some fantastic runners, and learn more about our sport. So if you're looking for a headlamp, you can wear what Adam Campbell was wearing, what Killian Jornet is wearing, and well, heck, what Scott and I are wearing. I put you and I, Scott, in the same breath there as those great runners. Put on a Petzl now. Enjoy the reactive lighting. Put on that Tika RXP and enjoy that lamp. They're both fantastic. Go to Petzl.com and check them out.
Are we recording?
Faith, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
1-3-4-5-6.
Check.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warr.
Joining us with... Well, go ahead, Scott. Well, roll with it.
First of all, what is our altitude here? I better check. We're at 89... We're at 9,000 feet in the air in Silverton, Colorado, getting ready for the Hard Rock 100, the 2014 Hard Rock 100. And I'll tell you already, I can't breathe.
You know, this is a fantastic site for a race. We're sitting here now at the race check-in, and we're with
with John Evans from Petzl, which we've had the chance to stay at his house, have a ride over here from Salt Lake City to Silverton, Colorado, learned a lot, and we ran into David Horton, who's sitting just 5 feet from me. And I'll tell you what, this is going to be a pleasure. Mr. David Horton, welcome to the podcast, and we're looking forward to a couple of things. One, getting to know you, and number two, going through an article that we found that says you can run an ultra run. You can, and it goes through some of the tenets.
So one of the things that we're doing this weekend is we're trying to get an idea and reporting on the atmosphere and the ambiance and the culture and the feel and the actual technical aspects of Hard Rock 100. In the runner's manual, it says that Hard Rock 100 is a postgraduate ultra race, which means you have to qualify, you have to be really prepared for this. And on our drive-in, just looking at the peaks that these runners have to go over, it intimidates. I think that's the only word I can think of is intimidates. But so we thought is, yes, this is a postgraduate run. Most of the runners that are here are very well qualified and are hardened by the trail. But we want to put that in a juxtaposition. Catch that word?
Yep.
Juxtaposition with everybody can run an ultra. And David Horton actually teaches a class on how to run an ultra, a college level class. Do they get credit for that?
They sure do.
How many credits is that worth?
Just 1 hour. But they work much, much harder than that.
Oh, I bet.
I've had many students tell me before that they worked harder for this class than any other class they've ever taken in college.
I would agree with that.
David, tell me, how did you get started with running? Where did it all start for you?
Started many, many years ago. I started running in college after playing basketball all my life. And I started running and ran a cross-country race. For my dorm, and my first race ever, I'd never really run. I finished second. It bugged me that I couldn't catch the first place guy. But and the cross country coach happened to be standing there, and he said, "If you ever get tired of basketball, come see me." So I was a walk on the basketball team, and the coach said, "If I make the team," and I made the team, he'd give me a scholarship, and he had one available, and he wouldn't do it. And so when you say you're going to do something to me, you should do that, and he didn't. And so I quit and went saw the track coach, and he said, I said, "I'm here." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know. Run." And so he put me with the sprinters the first day. And then the second day he put me with the distance runners. He saw right away that I wasn't a sprinter. So my first race as a college freshman was a mile race. And he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know. How about sub 5 minutes?" So I ran 4:59. So that was sort of the start. And then later, for a few years, I didn't run much. And then I started running when I was consistently when I was 27, studying at the University of Arkansas on my doctorate. And that's when I started running. My physiology teacher was a runner, and he was starting this race called the Hog Eye Marathon in Fayetteville. And I ran it the first year and dropped out after 20 miles. And that was the start of my running career. Dropping out of a race.
Now, how well did you prepare for that race? What did you know about running a full distance race like that?
I really knew very, very little. I'd been running 6 weeks, and actually as a relay race as well. And so I thought, well, I'll get a relay team, and I couldn't find but two others. So I said, well, I think maybe I can run the first 13 miles, then hand it off, and thought, well, I'll just see if I can't keep on running and finish this whole thing. Well, I didn't. I couldn't. And then I dropped out at 20 miles. And so then I trained for the entire next year. And the next year I ran the race and finished the race.
Fantastic. And I'm sure with an improved time.
3:23:54. Not that I remember exactly.
and so that leapfrogged into a whole career of running.
Yes, it did. I remember I finished that marathon 6 weeks before I got my doctorate. And at the time, if you had said, okay, you can have only one of these, which one do you want? I would have said the marathon finish.
Wow.
It meant a lot to me. I thought, wow, 3:23:54, under 8 minutes a mile. I thought, wow, I'll never be able to run faster. And so I graduated and got my degree, education doctor at the University of Arkansas, and went to Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and ran two or three more marathons. And then I was reading in Running Times about this race called the JFK 50 miler. And they showed people up on the Appalachian Trail running. And I thought, huh, I think I'd like to do that. So when I went to do the race in 1979, I'd never met anyone who had ever run an ultra or talked to anyone who had done an ultra. And I went to that and finished 24th out of 400 runners and 743, not that I remember.
Wow.
And I thought, hey, I can do this.
So that blows my mind. You've run a marathon and now you're going to run a 50 miler. How did you change your training? You didn't talk to anybody, right?
Right. Well, believe it or not,
how did you approach that?
Believe it or not, I had 4 weeks of training that I trained, I thought was really hard. And I did 120, 100, 120, and 100, 400 plus mile weeks and ran that 50 mile race. And I was doing pretty good till I had some issues with my stomach. I did talk to someone. I called this guy named Dr. Tom Osler at the time, and I said, what do you do for a drink? He said, well, I drink heavily sugared tea. And I said, well, how much? He said, well, I make a gallon of tea, and I put 2 pounds of sugar in it. And so I mixed it up at home, mixed that tea up at home, and put the 2 pounds of sugar in it, and stirred it up and spit it out. Oh, it was horrendous. I thought, well, he said this works, so I took it to the race. And I didn't drink it at first. Then at 16 miles, I drank it. Hey, that's not too bad. Then at 20 miles, I drank some. Hey, that's good. 24 miles, hey, that's not too bad. But again, it's too much sugar. And too much sugar retards stomach emptying. And then finally, I got sick, threw up, and quit drinking it, but finally made it through. So it's interesting. That was he was sort of smart. He was a math professor. Sugar and tea has caffeine in it. He was just way ahead of his time.
Now, how did you distribute it out on the course? Were you carrying it with you?
Actually, I had a crew at the time, and uh-huh. You could have a crew. And so my crew was meeting me, and they was giving me the heavily sugared tea.
Hmm.
Were you eating anything?
I don't remember.
Okay.
My guess, probably not. If it was, it probably wasn't much. That was the dark ages. I mean, that was thought to be a trail race, and now it's got 13 miles of the Appalachian Trail, and the rest of it, there's a dirt path, the CNO Canal towpath, 26 miles and 8 miles of pavement into the end, and that was thought to be a trail race. And in the early 80s, when I was running ultras, nearly all races were road races. They weren't trail races. And, of course, now there's not hardly any real road races, nearly all trail races.
Do you see that ever changing at any time of coming back to a 100K road race series or attracting a group? Go ahead.
Only one way do I see that coming back, and I think there is a potential. Remember a few years ago, won the Olympics in Greece,
mm-hmm.
And every hosting nation gets to have their own special sport that they can sort of add.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everyone thought that they would add 100K because Giannis Kouros was from Greece.
Right.
They thought, here's a guy, this is set up for it. So I think if it ever gets into the Olympics, 100K in the Olympics, that you'll start seeing 100K road races, but not until something like that happens, or not until if someone came in with some big money and or a series like that. I think possibly you get more people doing it. But again, trails, it's for the masses better. You know, you're not running against the time and the clock as much as against the course and yourself.
Right.
So I don't see the 100K happening unless they get something in the Olympics.
I would like to come back to what Scott brought up earlier, and that was you teach a class. And I don't know if I've ever seen a class schedule that includes an ultra running. Number one, how did you convince the faculty that this was a class that you should be able to teach? Because that's the great one right there. Get to teach your favorite subject.
Well, basically, we had activity classes, and I was into running. I said, well, let me have a running class. So I have a beginning running class. And then I thought, well, I need another activity for those who are a little bit better runners. So let me have a beginning, an advanced running class. So basically, we just needed activity classes. And I started beginning running class and advanced running class. And the beginning class, I require them to do a lot of different things. And one of the things is just complete a 5K, no certain time, as well as run a certain number of miles. Whereas in advanced running class, they had to complete 50K or longer.
Did you see that smile kind of curl up when he said it? He goes, they have to complete a 50. And he had this little grimace on his face. I love it.
Well, actually, completing a 50K with an adequate amount of training and knowledge is not super difficult. Now, racing a 50K is very difficult. It's like running a marathon. Running a marathon is not that hard in a way, if you know sort of what to do, but racing a marathon is another story. So that's it. Basically, I don't try to get them to race a 50K until I see some talent. Mm-hmm. And, of course, every once in a while, I see some talent. And I've had some very talented runners who have come through my class. And I've really encouraged them. So, basically, they really don't have to complete the 50K. They think they have to.
Well, if they listen to this podcast. Go ahead,
Scott. So, I would assume that most of the people, most of the students have never even heard of ultra running. How do they get signed up for your class? How many people, how many kids show up or sign up for the class?
Well, I usually have 20 in my beginning and 15 in my advanced, and I run the classes concurrently. And so some of my beginning students, they'll sign up for beginning, but they'll end up doing the ultra too. They get sucked in.
Oh, we know that.
and I am a good salesman. I am a good sucker. I suck them in. And I make the running class fun. We run anywhere and everywhere. We run through trails, through the middle of the woods, through buildings, through classrooms. And of course, I've had some issues injury-wise in the last few years, and so I bike with them now. Well, we bike anywhere and everywhere, and I bike through buildings, through classrooms. And then at least once or twice a semester, we'll have a mud fight. We'll have a day where you, if you find a snake, you get an automatic shirt. If you have a fall and get good blood, you get an automatic technical shirt. I make it fun. I make it interesting. And it's got a real history around Liberty University.
David, is your university accredited?
That's good.
It was, Scott.
So I just caught something. This class is called an advanced running class. It's not called let's run an ultra class. So they don't find out they need to ride a 50K until after they've signed up, before the drop date passes.
They can get the syllabus ahead of time, and then they come in the first day, and I tell them what's required. And I said, you can do this. You can do more than you think you can. I said, in fact, this class can change your life. And this class has changed lots of lives, and it can change your life. Now, I don't like sissies. There's girl sissies, and there's guy sissies. I don't like whiners. So if you think you're a whiner, you're a sissy, you can't get a little blood, you can't fall down, drop this class. Don't take this class. Do I run off a few? One or two. And I've found guys, in many cases, are bigger sissies than girls. And more girls take my classes than guys do. I don't know why.
Have you found some people that have just been shocked and amazed at how much they can do?
You can't believe some of the emails that I get or letters that I get after students complete an ultra. It's just amazing. In fact, sometimes I'll keep some of the letters and read it to the students in the future. Yeah. You changed my life. This class changed my life. This was an amazing class. I won't ever view myself the same because I was able to accomplish more than I ever thought. And if I can do this with a class after one semester, what can I do in life and what can I withstand in life?
If I was in class and you said this class can change your life and I raised my hand at maybe a skeptic, maybe not, just curious, and I'd say, Dr. Horton, how is this going to change my life?
It can change your life about how you feel about yourself physically and what you can accomplish and what challenges you can achieve, what you can go through, what you can do. We may accidentally on purpose run through briars. We may accidentally get lost. You may accidentally get lost. You will fall sooner or later. So it's just, I think people realize they're tougher than they think they are. Our society today, I think we're raising lots of soft people. And they're looking for something. They're looking for challenges. And it appeals to a certain group of people.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Jared Campbell that's out here today or tomorrow that's going to be running. I think he said our society is too air-conditioned. Everything is too comfortable. Everything is within hand's reach of convenience. You know, we have cars, we have thermostats, we have refrigerators, that our bodies aren't challenged and this is an expression of ourselves, these long distance runs and these briar patches, as you call them.
And of course, Jared Campbell, one of two-time finishers of Barclay,
right.
Amazingly tough person. If this course, if there was no trail tomorrow, Jared Campbell would win.
Did he take your class?
He would have done well. He would have loved my class.
He would have got a lot of the bloody knee points.
He would have been the TA, the teacher's assistant, you know.
Well, for example, when the students come in the first day, I said, you know, one of the things, like I said, I don't like sissies. I said, and you can withstand much more than you think you can. I've peed blood, I've puked blood, I've crap blood in a race and gone on. You can too. Should you do that? Depends. If you're close to the finish line, you bet. You suck it up and you go on. You're way out there. No, that's a little bit different story. And I said, with respect to using, they said, well, what happens if we're out there somewhere and we have to go to the bathroom? Well, I've used T-shirts, socks, shorts, rocks, corn cobs, corn shucks, snow, hand, and you get some of these eyeballs. And so, like I said, I lose one or two after the first class.
Have you changed some sissies into runners?
Yes. Yes, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure there's been some sissies in my class before that are not now. And I give nicknames, too. I give nicknames to the runners. And, and you know, in fact, you know, at Liberty University, we used to have a sign below our sign that said, "Welcome to Liberty University, the politically incorrect school." And if there's ever anyone that's politically incorrect, it's probably me. So I, for example, some of the nicknames: Chicken Boy, Idiot, Fat Girl, Heifer. Those are just some of the nicknames that people get.
Heifer?
Sure. In fact, I was in Charlotte Airport last year, and I saw Heifer. She'd graduated 4 or 5 years ago. I saw Heifer walking through, and I hollered. I said, "Heifer." And I saw her head turn. I said, "Heifer, you heard your name." And she came to and she said, "Oh," she said, "I was so good to hear that, Dave." In fact, I get many emails. And sometimes students will say, "You know, the one thing I really didn't like about your class." And it's just, boy, my heart skips beat. And I said, "Yeah. What? What? You didn't give me a nickname."
Oh, really?
And so they want nicknames.
Yeah.
Sure. I imagine that after taking that class and then you're busy going through your collegiate career and then you start your family, there comes a point that you may call back to that experience of that class of being a runner and think, you know what? I'm going to go back out there and do that again. So there could be a time that you're dormant and get to go back. And that's the nice thing about this sport, about running, is that there you can always go back. Now, if you're a gymnast, I think it's you might be there. You might miss your window, but you don't miss a window with running.
Yeah, I've had a number of students who I said, you know, the majority of you are not going to become runners. My goal is for you to become a runner. And they'll say, well, what's a runner? Yeah. And I said, I have different definitions, and you can always think about this. Most of you will not. You think, I'm sort of putting you down. No, I said, no, I'm just being truthful. What's a runner? A runner is someone who is committed. They're going. It's not are they going to run? It's when are they going to run? It's not. And also ask your question, do I get to run or do I have to run? Mm. If you get to run, that indicates that you're a runner. If it's something you're going to do on a regular basis. In fact, I know some runners that never race. You don't have to race to be a runner. It's commitment. It's regularity.
So you can have somebody that is a 7 mile, 7 minute mile athlete, and you can have one that is a 14 per minute mile athlete. And it's possible that your 14 miler could be the runner.
Sure.
Because they're passionate. They love it. Sure. They don't need to set an alarm to get up to go out. They just love it.
Yeah. Yeah. They love it. They're going to do it. And that's really neat to see someone become a runner. And it's not always the most talented people. It's not always the fastest people. In fact, that's sort of depressing. Sometimes some of those people will stop. And some of the people that I think, I'm not sure how much they get out of this class. And then later they'll email me back and say, hey, I ran my another marathon. I ran another ultra. I've had students email me back and say, hey, I ran my first 100 miler. And so that's really neat. And they know that I like it, that I care about it, that I understand what they've done and what they've accomplished.
I would love to see, sorry, Scott, did you have something?
Nope, you go.
I would love to see this. I would love to take that class for one. I wish it was an online class because I would take that as well. But I would love to see the syllabus. Do you talk about like hydration? Do you talk about chafing? Do you talk, what does that syllabus look like? And I'd buy the textbook and I would buy it. I wouldn't borrow it. I would buy that one.
I don't have to have a textbook, and I used to use textbooks, but I've had so many experiences. I don't use one. So, but I always, we always have a discussion part at the beginning of class. Then we go out to run. And as the semester goes on, we discuss less and run more, but I always close the door because I never know what I'm going to say. I never know what they're going to ask. Any questions are open for you to ask or anything for you to say. And for example, you talk about chafing. You talk about diarrhea. Mm-hmm. You talk about chipple.
The old chipple. The chipple.
You talk about people who have problems with, you know, eating certain things and bathroom, as yeah. I just talked about. You know, that's something that if someone walked by and they heard those things, it might not go over real well.
May not be politically correct. I jumped over.
No, I was going to say, I'd like to get into the points in his article. This was an article that was published in April of 2014 in Ultra Running Magazine. It's available online. We'll connect the or link it to the podcast description. But I want to go through these points and we can discuss them if we need to, or some of them are pretty self-explanatory. The first one is the number one goal should be to complete a race within the time limits. So this is how to run a first 50K.
So it doesn't matter your time. It's start to finish. That is the end goal.
Well, that's the goal for the majority of these runners tomorrow. As well as the next day, is to finish within 48 hours. There'll be some people racing, and there'll be a bunch of really good people at the front, and there'll be some people in the middle, and there'll be some people at the back. But the number one goal for the majority of these runners this weekend, because of the difficulty of the race, should be to complete it within 48 hours, to kiss that rock.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've run this race. Let's talk about that. Yeah, you're a veteran out here and have run this.
I won it the first 2 years. Then thereafter, I had second place and two thirds, and I had one DNF here. Mentally, I just wasn't ready 1 year. But yeah, I was here when it first started. It was an amazing thing.
So he ran by that first word. It wasn't run. He won the first 2 years, as in first place. Now, and then,
did they have the same rock to kiss back then?
No rocks to kiss back then.
When did you start kissing the rock?
I'm not sure when that was. In fact, I never did kiss the rock, and I'm not so sure I missed kissing the rock.
We were talking to race director Dale Garland, and he was saying that there was one person that came in that did not refuse to kiss it, and we were joking with him that the clock is still running.
Yes,
right?
yes.
So again, back to this beginner. We're trying to graduate from beginner running 101 up to
our postgraduate,
which is Hard Rock. The second point you have on here is to pick an established 50K that is noted for a high finish rate, 90% or better. For you, where you live, what 50Ks are the right 50Ks? What do they typically choose?
I would say mine. Holiday Lake 50K, which is relatively easy 50K for 50K. It has 2,000 feet of gain. And then I have direct the Promised Land 50K, which has 7,400 feet of elevation gain. They can do others, and sometimes they do others, but most of the time they do mine. And that's good because nearly all the students do the same ultra. And so I always tell them, okay, number one goal, do you want to come in Monday or the next class meeting and not wear the finisher's award and not be the one who didn't finish? So put good pressure on them to finish. And nearly all of them do.
Now, I think somewhere in that article, if I'm not mistaken, you had encouraged runners to find something with some elevation because it slows you down and makes you a little more disciplined.
Oh, the worst thing in the world would be to go and find a 10K course and do it three times plus a little out and back or something on flat pavement. Oh, it's like which one hurts you more, a fast marathon or on roads or a fast 50-miler in the mountains? There's no doubt that the fast marathon would hurt you more. I used to run marathons. Gosh, the next day it would be hard for me to walk. My hamstrings would be so sore. And I've run 50-milers where the next day I felt fine.
How do you teach your students to learn how to pace themselves?
Mainly with respect to breathing rate.
Okay.
Breathing rate from the standpoint of basically your body burns fats or carbohydrates as a source of fuel, and you have a limited store of carbohydrates. And when you're breathing hard, the only fuel, the energy system they're using there is the glycolytic system. The only thing you can burn in the glycolytic system are carbs. You got enough for about 3 hours there. And that's why people hit the wall at 18 to 22 miles per marathon. They burn up all their glycogen stores, which are carbs. They burn up all their carbs. So basically, I tell them to check their breathing rate. If you're breathing hard, that means you're burning carbs more so than fat, and you have a limited store of that. So basically, I tell them to check their breathing rate. If they're breathing hard, slow down, and so that you burn fats.
So what about on a course like Hard Rock out here, that if you look at the profile, you are either, you know, going straight up or straight down? How do you manage your effort level in a course that doesn't really give you much of a chance to do any personal management?
You can't. You sort of can't here at Hard Rock, because, again, even if it's sort of like in biking, they try to keep the same cadence and just shift gears. Well, the hills are so steep out here that you have to you're going to exercise a higher heart rate. It's just very, very difficult with something this steep.
So are there some body types that are just built better for climbing because they can run at a higher heart rate or have a better VO2 max? Or, you know, 'cause we're all a bit different.
Again, everyone is born with a certain max VO2 potential, and you can increase that maybe 20 to 25%. Beyond that, you can't. I mean, you think about Matt Carpenter, who has one of the highest ever recorded. It just has a natural potential. It's like a Ferrari motor. A Ferrari motor is always a Ferrari motor. A Volkswagen motor is always a Volkswagen motor. You can improve that Volkswagen motor and get better mileage and go farther, but it can still never have the power. So basically, you know, some of these guys tomorrow will be running up these mountains, whereas other people will have difficulty walking up these mountains, much less walking up the mountains continuously, having to stop and breathe. So everyone can improve, but you always have to face genetic potential. Some people just have a greater genetic potential than others.
And let's talk a little bit. Scott was talking on the write-up and looking at the face of these mountains and talking about acclimatization to the elevation. And how do you go from sea level or 1,200 feet and live up, you know, and run a successful race up here? Do you have any suggestions and comments?
Get you an altitude tent.
Yeah.
Do blood doping. take EPO. And I shouldn't say that really, because maybe someone might do that. Do those things work? Oh, without a doubt. Tent's legal. Blood doping's not. EPO is not. Then other than that, what can you do? You can come up here 3 weeks ahead of time. That's what I would do. I live in Virginia at 800 feet, and I came out here 3 weeks ahead of the race, and so I'd get to train about 2.5 hard weeks, and your body adjusts somewhat, but it's still not fair compared to people who live at elevation. Living, and you know, you think about who are the best distance runner in the world, the Kenyans, where they live at 7,000 feet. And there's adaptations that occur over generations, not just weeks or months or a lifetime. So that's part of the reason. I'm sure they overall have a much higher max VO2 genetic potential than other people. I mean, you could take Americans and take them to Kenya and train, and they're still not going to be able to compete overall.
Mm. So, but you can make a difference in the 2.5 weeks, because that's what you said. You get up here, you'll experience.
What happens? Blood plasma will change in just a day or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a couple of days, your plasma will go up, which will help you a little bit. Red blood cells, you'll see some change there. Plasma is quick. Mm-hmm. Red blood cells is not. You know, you think about, you can give blood plasma in twice a week, whereas you can give blood only basically that once every 6 weeks. So that's saying it's 6 weeks to replace that pint of blood before you can give it again. So 3 weeks, you can make a pretty good adjustment. There's only been one runner ever that I've known of that's really finished in the front, close to the front of the pack, who came directly from sea level. A guy came from New York City once and came here and finished second, ran about 27, 28 hours. And I don't know of anyone else who has done that.
Can you talk to us about the tent? Do you think they're that much of an edge, a benefit? If you were running an altitude race and you were in Virginia, what kind of changes? How long do you need to be in it? What's your thought?
It would help.
Yeah.
It would help. Because basically, it's forcing the body into a situation where the availability of oxygen is not as great. So that will cause the bone marrow to increase red blood cell production. So, yes, it would help me run better and faster, even in living in Virginia, than it would here. But where it really helps you would be if you're coming to a high-altitude race.
So along that same line, you come out here 3 weeks prior to the race, which is typically getting close to when you should start tapering your running miles and intensity, right?
Excuse me. I think Americans are really soft in that area. I think people taper way too much, way too long. Basically, I'd come out here and I'd do my last sort of long run, which is 20 miles on Monday. And the race day was Friday start. And I'd do 25 or 30 on Saturday, you know, just 6 days before the race, and ran well. And I know Killian has been out here running all for several, maybe a couple of weeks. And I know I saw someone that saw him running this afternoon. And I saw someone that saw him in the mountains earlier this week. So, I think people don't need taper near as much as they do. Once you get in shape, for people running their first ultra, maybe even first 100 mile, maybe you need to taper a little bit longer. But if you've been running for a number of years, I think people taper too much. I really do.
And you said Americans are too soft on that. So you see something over in Europe. Do they have a different approach?
Yeah, they don't taper as long. They train harder. And the other thing, too, faster running, especially the week of the race, increases blood plasma. So it's a little bit of good blood doping to run faster.
One of the points on here that we often talk about or have talked about many times is don't worry about getting a good night's sleep the night before the race.
That's right.
It's more important to get the good sleep two nights before the race.
And it's really not necessarily two nights before. It's the cumulative effect of that week. If you had one night, yes, let's say you're racing normally on a Saturday, the Thursday night. But really, it's what did you get Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And then the night before, it doesn't matter.
Do you advocate getting more sleep than you're used to?
Nope.
Before a race?
Nope. You can't bank sleep. You can't, just like fitness, you can't bank fitness. You have to maintain it. Sleeping more doesn't do that. You just have to go to bed. And really, it's going to bed earlier. And a regular schedule. Then the other thing, for people who live here, they'd be better. Because sleeping in your own bed, you rest better.
So the question, you are very familiar with a lot of different races. You've been to a lot of races. You've raced a lot of races. Tell us a little bit about what makes Hard Rock unique. Are there any other races that are even close to this race?
Well, I would think Wasatch is somewhat close. Maybe not as pretty. Bear is a great race. Bighorn, those are sort of like that, but they don't have the huge elevation changes they have here. From what I understand, there's no place in the lower 48 states that you have the elevation change that you, in terms of height and depth, that you have around this area. So that makes it tougher because of that. As far as I know, there's nothing really close. And like I said, Wasatch is probably as close as any of them in terms of being like that. Plus the beauty of it. I ran Leadville, thought it was pretty, and then I ran Western, and I thought it was really pretty. And then I ran Hard Rock, and I saw what true pretty was. Mm-hmm. This is true pretty, true beauty.
That's why they give away a photo instead of a belt buckle, right?
I guess, or maybe it's cheaper too.
If you could wave a magic wand and allow more than 140 runners, if that's the magic number, 140, and BLM and all the regulating authorities, would you wave a wand and say, let there be 280 or 500?
Yes and no. Yes, from the standpoint of if I could go to one regular race and run again, which I can't right now, I would come to Hard Rock. So I'd like for more people to experience it. But then again, the being in this gym, this small area, the closeness of it, that's the problem with numbers. And I hope and think they will increase the numbers over the next several years. From what I understand, that maybe they're going to be able to do that. And I think that's a good thing, a little more. But still, I mean, 1,200 people that want to get in this year and 140 gets in. So it's sort of a bad thing. It's a tough thing. So I'd like for more people to experience it. But I have mixed emotions there. I'd like to see it get bigger, but not 1,000, 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it'd be good for it.
Yeah.
And they won't. It won't happen.
Right.
It might go up to, 200, 250 someday, but I don't think it'll ever be a gigantic race.
Do you have another question on there,
Scott? I have one question that I want to answer, but at the end of the podcast.
All right.
So if you have any, John, do you have any questions you want to ask the great David Horton?
I think I turned his mic off or something. I'm sorry, John.
I'd love to hear one of your most epic hard rock stories, like a night of tremendous thunderstorms or bears or mountain lions.
I don't necessarily have any bear stories. I've had some bad weather during some of the races. Some of mine was a couple of times, and I don't know where it is, in a victory or second place or third place, being in the lead and turning off my light and making my pacer turn off his lights too, so that other runners couldn't see where I was or where I was going, because I knew there was a couple of times that I thought they might have trouble with that turn.
You're not competitive, are you?
It doesn't matter what I do. I want to beat anyone and everyone and as many people as I can.
When in your class, I'd like to open that syllabus again and open the under the heading mental toughness. Do you cover that at all, the mental side of running?
Without a doubt. I mean, you're only as strong as your mind is. Your body's always stronger than your mind is. The mind is the weak link. How do you get a stronger mind? I think it's just the daily act of doing what you're supposed to be doing and meeting smaller challenges and bigger challenges and bigger challenges, and also people having faith in you. You know, we tend to think that even running marathons, that you need to do a 5K, 10K, half marathon, then marathon. I have a lot of students, maybe even hundreds, who have done ultras that have never done a marathon. And see, we tend to think you need to do a marathon for that. So, and it's all in the mind, knowing how to do it. And I know some mistakes that people make, and I can help people finish. I can help people run faster if they're willing to. And mentally, it's so important to be mentally tough. To a certain extent, I think some people are born mentally tougher than others. I was born and raised on a farm. I'm so thankful for that. It's just like dogs. I'm not afraid of dogs except pit bulls. Because pit bulls, they bite and they hold on and they don't turn loose. That's just their breed.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see pit bulls. And what kind of people are pit bulls? Basically, it's motivated, driven, goal-oriented people. That's the kind of people I like to have in my class. I don't care whether they're fast, male or female. I like people who are goal-oriented, goal achievement, that are tough and not sissies.
Did you ever give the nickname Pit Bull?
I haven't.
Mm.
But the only thing about it, I might not like it now because they might think about the musician, but I need to remember that one. But I wouldn't give it unless they deserved it.
Sure.
I wouldn't give it unless they deserved it.
Toughest runner you've ever seen. Who is it? Yourself excluded. Being competitive, I know you had to think, who's tougher than me? Toughest male runner, toughest female?
Maybe the toughest male is Josh Cox. Josh Cox is the poster boy for Power Bar. You'll see his legs everywhere. And he graduated from Liberty and ran a couple of ultras. He's the U.S. record holder for 50K, which is a contrived 50K. Josh do a real 50K. He ran a marathon, then went to a track and ran five more miles. And he's the record holder for 50K for the United States. He's highly competitive, and he's mentally tough, too. I don't know. Mentally tough. That's the thing about it. There's not a lot of mentally, super-duper mentally tough people. I think I was, but I never know until I line up on the starting line each time, and no one ever knows for sure. Girls, I have a fat girl. That's Bethany Patterson. She was one of my students, and I call her Fat Girl. And people, they give me a hard time about calling her Fat Girl, but you know, she's not fat. You can't call a girl who's not fat or a fat girl, you can't call her fat because you get in trouble there. But she is really mentally tough. She really wants to win. She really likes beating people. And she liked beating me in races and training too. And so that's a hard thing to find.
Have you ever kicked someone out of your class because they were whiny? Or recommended they drop the class?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've recommended a number of people drop the class because they whine and complain too much. I said, look, this is the way this class is. I explained it the first day. You should get out of here. Didn't you believe me when I told you that I wasn't going to deal with this? And of course, have I been wrong a few times? Yeah, I remember one time I was running with my class and I'll do all sorts of loops and stuff to try to keep the class together because there are a variety of abilities. And we loop back and here's this guy coming along and he has a pretty girl under one arm and a pretty girl under his other arm and they're sort of carrying him along. And I said, what are you doing that for? Well, I think I broke my foot. I said, you didn't break your foot. I said, you go back to the gym right now, and you ladies come on and go with me. And so we went on and running. We finished the run.
You just wanted to run with the pretty ladies.
That's right. And we went on and finished the run and got back to the gym. He said, still hurting. And he went to the doctor. He had a broken foot. And then I had the same thing happen this past year. We jumped in the pond. We was having a mud fight. This guy said, I think I broke my foot. I said, you didn't break your foot. He broke his foot. So anyway, there's some interesting things that happen in the class.
Excellent. Well, I'm interested, and usually Trail Runner Nation, we don't do this, but I'm gonna because we're here, and because you have seen and know many of these runners, I want to get your idea of who you think is going to perform well tomorrow. Not necessarily win. Who's going to perform well tomorrow?
Run tough.
The toughest runner that I know of out there, there's two really tough ones out there. It may be tougher than anybody else that I know of out there. Jared Campbell and, of course, Scott Hyme. Both of them are really tough. Jared Campbell is unreal tough. There's Barkley 100 miler over in Tennessee. There's been 14 people ever finished it, and only two have ever finished it twice in 25-year history of the race. Jared Campbell has finished it twice. He is unreal tough, but he doesn't have the talent some of those other guys in front of him has. And Scott Hyme's unreal tough. And both of them train really hard, but there's some other guys that have more talent. So those are the two of the toughest runners out there. And Diana Finkel is really tough too. She's tough that she can almost hurt herself, and she has hurt herself here at this race. One year I thought she was going to win it. But anyway, those are two tough ones. You didn't ask me who I thought was going to win tomorrow.
No, I think that was a good way to position. Did you want to say who do you think is going to win?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well,
the obvious choice is Kilian Jornet. Obvious choice. He is the most talented runner in this field, without a doubt. He may be short distance, and I mean short distance by 100 miles and under. The best runner ever, ultra distance runner ever, is Giannis Kors. That's beyond question. How much beyond question is that? And I always tell students this, think about this. How about running a 7:38 mile? Sort of hard. How about running 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? How about doing it for 24 hours? Giannis Kors averaged 7:38 for 24 hours, 188 miles. Amazing. Well, Kilian Jornet is probably the best ever 100 miles under. Giannis Kors is probably the best ever beyond. So the obvious choice is Kilian Jornet, but I'm going to go with Dakota Jones. There's some other real fast. I'm going to go with Dakota because he's run it before. He lives around here. He's young. He has something to prove. He's beaten Jornet before, so he's not intimidated by him. And Jornet, I think he could get lost. I'm not sure how bad he wants it here. He's the obvious choice, but I'm going with Dakota.
How about on the women's side?
Hold on one second. If we took Jared Campbell's toughness and put it inside Kilian, would anybody touch him?
The best ever.
Yeah,
it'd be the best ever. Jared Campbell is just phenomenal.
Because I often ask myself, is it my brain that holds me back or my body? And you'll tell, you know, I mean, right? If I had a different brain, would I be Would I be faster?
Faster, but you wouldn't. You still got to have the body. You got to have the horsepower. You got to have the horsepower.
Right.
If you're going to race a car.
Right.
Jared Campbell, he has Kylian Jornet's body. He wins.
Yeah.
Hands down.
I want to come back to that comment that everybody has a different engine. Everybody has a different horsepower. Can anyone run an ultra? Can everyone run an ultra, I guess, is my question. Are there people that should?
Yes. Yes. Everything is possible given enough time. You can run around the world. Running across the United States, which I've done, is not a hard thing. Now, to race across the United States, that's very hard. So, I think anyone could run an ultra as long as there wasn't a time limit because you keep moving. You do it. I mean, how did they get from, they landed in the East Coast, and how did people get the West Coast? Not riding a wagon.
They walked.
On foot. So everyone can. It's just a question of how long. I tell students, I said, you know, all of us right now could run to Roanoke from Lynchburg, 50 miles away. All of us could. Some would take longer, but we all could. How far can you run? Read the book Long Walk, fiction book that Stephen King wrote. And it was a story of a race. And in the race, everyone starts. If you drop below 4 miles per hour, you're warned. Second warning, you're shot. And one by one, everyone is shot until the last one survives. How far can you run if someone has a gun telling you, I'm going to shoot you and kill you if you don't keep running? I always go into a class, in a normal class, in the speeds often, say, how far do you think you can run? Pick out someone. They say, I could run 5 miles. What if I'd write you a check for $1 million if you could run 7 miles? I could run 7. What if I told you if you don't run 10, you're dead? You could run 10. So you can do more than you think you can. The mind is the weak link.
You know, that's an interesting strategy that you could take into a long race
have your pacer bring a gun.
Yeah. now, you've threatened me as a pacer.
Yeah, I've told you I had a gun. now, we're talking toughness and we keep saying you can do more than you think you can do. But here's my question for you, David. Is there a time where we should shut down in your syllabus under the bullet point number 13? Under DNF, when is the time? When's the right time?
When is the time? It's sort of like, when should you not run? And that's one of the things I do try to teach and instruct the students. When should you not run a certain day or race? And that's sort of a hard thing to determine. When you have a fever, you possibly shouldn't run. Now, if you had a fever in a race, and you're at 98 miles, 100-mile race, no.
You finish it.
Yeah. But when you have a fever, you shouldn't run. How about shin splints? Can you run through shin splints? I've seen people run through shin splints, and it hurts, but you can still run.
Right.
And so I try to tell the students, you've got to learn to judge your own body with respect to pain. There's a difference between pain and discomfort. I don't like, and I hate the statement you think I would like, no pain, no gain. I don't like that statement. That is wrong. No discomfort, no gain.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning the difference between pain and learning the difference between pain and discomfort. And how can you learn that? Well, basically, there's some general guidelines with respect to if you have something that's hurting and it gets worse as you run, you shouldn't be running or you should stop. If you have a pain that comes and goes, that's not a bad thing. If you have a pain that moves around, that's not a bad thing. So basically, using those things, you can determine whether you should or should not run. Racing, how much does it mean to you? I've really entered one race that I knew I shouldn't be running. I had bronchitis, couldn't breathe, and I knew going up the first hill that I was in trouble. So there are times you shouldn't continue. I tried to set the record on the Colorado Trail, and I was ahead of the record through 5 or 6 days, and I finally stopped. The previous 4 days, every time I'd urinate blood, and it's observable blood. But I didn't stop because I just got weak and tired, and I was still able to move, so I didn't stop. But finally, I stopped the last day because I started getting swelling and fluid retention in my arms and my fingers. And I thought the skin was going to burst open. Mm. And the next section was too far that I didn't want to put other people in peril. Plus, I didn't know what would happen. So it's a hard thing to tell.
So listen to your own body.
Listen to your body and think about pains and know what is the difference between pain and discomfort. And only you can determine that. And you, on how you determine it, through trial and error and through experience. I've had my hamstrings before thought they were going to rip apart, but they didn't. You know, I think back to the story of a guy running a marathon and seeing a wagon load of hay, and the hay was leaning off the wagon, looked like it was going to fall, and he was dying and suffering, and he was going to have to run by the wagon. And he thought, I hope that hay falls on me and knocks me down and I'll have a good excuse to stop. And also tell students, can you get shot and continue running? There was a guy one time was running trying to qualify for Boston, and he was running a marathon, and he had this section where he ran through the woods at 16 miles and whap, something hit him up beside the head. And he thought, what is that? What was that? And he looked around. He couldn't see a rock. And he couldn't see anything. He thought, well, I don't know. Someone must hit me with a rock, but I can't find it. He kept on running. And as he ran, he got slower and slower. But he thought it was just the race and, you know, the length of the race. And he crossed the finish line. His wife was there. And his wife, he just missed qualifying for Boston. His wife said, well, hon, what's wrong? He said, I don't know, man. I don't feel so good. She said, well, you don't look good. She said, well, what happened? He said, I don't know. I got hit with a rock or something. She said, well, let me see. And she walked up to him and parted his hair, and she saw a hole. He had been shot, and there was a bullet lodged in his skull. So can you get shot and continue to run? Yes.
Is that pain or is that discomfort?
But he ran on, and he ran another 10 miles. And the Boston Marathon director heard about this and then let him in the race.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That is super cool.
But then again, he shouldn't have. Because if there's standards, you should go by the standards. Yeah. But I understand.
Yeah. Did we get your
I don't think so.
Prediction
for the women.
On women? Who you think is going to perform well? And
Diana Finkel and Darcy are, of course, the solid favorites. I think Diana will win. Diana's the more talented one. Darcy is unreal good, but Diana Finkel is really good. A few years ago, I saw her pass Jared Campbell to take the lead at like 60 miles, and I thought she was going to go on and win the race. Diana Finkel is really good, and Darcy is really good, but Diana is a little better. I predict Diana.
Okay. What about running longevity? If we can just sneak on that topic for just a second. How long are we competitive? Are we able to stay in that our peak form? Do you have a thought on that?
7 to 10 years.
Yeah, the 7 year.
That's that 7 year that we've been talking to.
Kevin Sawchuk, a runner in the Bay Area, has a theory of the 7 year. You have 7 competitive years, and yet it doesn't matter if you started at 23 to 30 or 30 to 37. You get your 7. You can even break them up. He said 3 and 4. That's his theory, and we've talked to everybody about it except him. So, but it's funny. You came up with the same 7, yeah. 7 to 10.
Well, they did a study. Several years ago with marathoners to see from the time they started running to the time they ran their best marathon, and the average was 10 years.
Uh-huh.
So 10 years of running. So it's not only physical development, it's mental development, and then learning how to eat, learning how to race. You have only so long. You can't compete at a super high level for a long, long time. But you can run and run a lot for a long, long time. I started running in 1977, and I ran from 77 to 2010, 33 years with no injuries. And in that 33 years, I ran a little over 113,000 miles, no injuries. What's an injury? An injury is something that prevents you from running. So I had aches and pains and problems like that. But and I averaged for 30 of those years, I put in over 3,000 miles.
How did you keep yourself passionate and motivated for 33 years? How did you keep that carrot?
Finding different challenges. And I did well for a long, long time. I won 40 races, and I ran somewhere around 150, 160. I lost the number of ultras, but it's finding new challenges. And actually, I set the PCT record, speed record, at age 55. and averaged 40 miles a day for 66 days, 7 hours, and 16 minutes.
You got a few numbers in your head.
Well, then the other numbers, right across America, 2,906 miles, 45.4 miles a day, average 9.15 per mile.
9.15?
Yes.
Wow.
How have you seen since 1977 the ultra community, the culture change within our trail running family?
In a way, not much. In a way, a lot. I mean, the media coverage, podcast, what's that?
Yeah.
When I first started running ultras, there was a booklet that came out, about 5 by 9 booklet at the end of the year that had all the results from all the races. And you didn't know anything about the races because they weren't published in papers and other stuff. And we didn't have internet. So that's changed. Instant results, instant gratification. Basically, it's going from road racing to trail racing. It'll continue being that way. The numbers, it's just booming. The industry, there's money in it now, which is good, bad. There's more faster youngers in it, which is, I think, a good thing. It used to be thought of as an old person sport, but now that's changing. I think that's a good thing. So the bad thing now is it's hard to get in races like this one. It's hard to get in other races. And that, I think that's a bad thing. That's a tough thing. And that can't be helped to a certain extent. But there's lots and lots more races, and that's a good thing.
And the trails are always open. Just because you're not wearing a bib, you know, Western States is open today. You could go to Squaw and start running towards Auburn if you wanted to.
Yes.
And so we have open trails, and that's the nice thing. The mountain never closes.
Right.
David Horton, did you ask your final question, Scott? You unloaded that sucker. I knew it was a big one. I saw it. I recognized it.
I snuck it in.
Yeah, good. David Horton, it has been our pleasure to sit with you and talk to you about and get to talk to a legend in the running community.
Remember what a legend is.
What's that?
It's someone who's done something. We don't remember exactly what it was, but he's done something. But anyway, yes. Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. I love talking about running and ultra running in particular. I teach in exercise science at Liberty University, and I'm encouraging people to be fit, to be active for a lifetime. And that's my goal. That's my objective. And ultra running is just a special niche of that. We're not exercising. I don't exercise for health and fitness. I exercise for performance, for competition.
Yeah, and you're still competing today. I could feel it here. If between the how many of us are here? 4 of us at this table. I don't think I want to line up on the start line with you right now.
Well, that was great. We appreciate it. Those of you who are listening that live on the East Coast, go enroll in Dr. Horton's class.
Sure.
That sounds like a great time.
Get a nickname.
Can you audit the class?
No.
Oh.
No, actually, that's not true. You can't audit it. And nearly every class meeting, I have veterans come back. I'll have anywhere from 4 to 6 people come in the class who have taken the class before. And if it's raining, the hordes of them come to the class because they know we'll have a mud run.
Yep. Trail Runner Nation, go out and grab some trail yourself, stay in shape, and make it a lifestyle choice.
Be tough.
Suck it up.
Avoid
Buttercup.
It, and avoid the nickname that could stick with you for the rest of your life. So go out and run.
Moss.